Hallo und herzlich willkommen. Hello and welcome to History and Politics, the Körber Stiftung's podcast that deals with the question of how and why history shapes the present. My name is Gabriele Wojdelko, and I'd like to warmly welcome Katja Heuer and Oliver Moody, our special hosts of our special podcast series, The New Germany. It's already half time of the New Germany season number 2. And in this third episode, we will be dealing with the past and present of German-Polish relations. We are very excited to welcome a special guest and a renowned expert on exactly this topic, that is Karolina Wigura. Now over to you, Katja and Oliver. Let's get started.
I should start this episode by apologizing in advance to the listeners for the act of linguistic violence that is about to come out of my mouth. But, dzień dobry.
Nicely done. I'll go for the safer guten Tag, dear listeners.
Welcome to The New Germany, a special podcast series brought to you by the Körber Stiftung's History and Politics team.
In each episode, we take a look at one of the many uncertainties and certainties that Germany has had to rethink as the war in Ukraine holds a mirror to its face. Like a middle-aged man, the country had become rather comfortable, perhaps a little bit complacent too.
Things that had once come effortlessly, like staying fighting fit, keeping up with innovation, or having clear foreign policy principles, suddenly seem to require an inordinate amount of energy these days.
Old relationships have gone a little bit stale, more bickering than professions of deep love, while new ones offered enticing but dangerous possibilities. What will Germany do as the world around it changes? Will Olaf Scholz's promise of Zeitenwende truly reinvigorate the country? Or will it turn out to be no more than a little bit of nip and tuck?
Well, that midlife personal trainer come cosmetic surgeon to the German nation over there is Katja Heuer, a German-born historian and journalist living in Britain.
And here to inject some youthful enthusiasm is Oliver Moody, a British journalist based in Berlin.
And as you may have gathered from my atrocious Polish and Katja's mellifluous Brandenburg German at the beginning, today's episode is about the Polish-German relationship, which the Bulgarian political thinker Ivan Krastev has recently argued will be as important to the future of the European Union as the Franco-German relationship was back in the 1950s.
But while Germany has long seen France as a major player in Europe and a key partner whose goodwill and cooperation it deemed essential to the process of its reinvention and rebuilding after the Second World War, Poland has never gained the same status in German thinking. During the four decades of Cold War divisions, old wounds between the two countries continued to fester. Poland's integration into the European Union has not been enough to heal them. In many ways, the war in Ukraine would have been a moment of reconciliation. Or perhaps it should have been. This time, Germany and Poland stand on the same side as Russian soldiers march onto European soil. Yet the war seems to have had the opposite effect, and German-Polish relations have reached a critical low. This episode asks, how have we got to this point? Where are we now? And is there a way forward? Can there be a Zeitenwende in the German-Polish relationship?
For once, history is not just a dispiriting dumpster fire of ancient hatreds, to recycle that awful lazy phrase Western journalists like me used to use about the Balkans. There have certainly been some rough patches between Poland and Germany over the centuries, but there have also been long periods of peace, stability and even cooperation. So to crunch about 900 years of history into 2 minutes, Poland emerged as a distinct entity under the Piast dynasty at the end of the first millennium AD. And a lot like the German states to the west of it, it began expanding into and Christianizing bits of Central Europe that had previously been fairly thinly settled by other Slavic peoples. Mostly, Poland had a fairly cordial relationship with the Holy Roman Emperor, but at the same time as fighting border wars with some of its individual German neighbours and inviting German settlers to help populate some of its newly acquired domains. In fact, it was actually a Polish duke, Conrad of Mazovia, who first sent for the Teutonic Knights to help him break down pagan Prussia in the 1220s. But the relationship went a bit sour when the Teutonic Order started grabbing Polish and Lithuanian territory. So in 1410, they met in a vast battle at Tannenberg, also sometimes referred to as Grunwald, which was probably one of the biggest single engagements of the Middle Ages and ended in a decisive Polish-Lithuanian victory that marked the beginning of the end for the Teutonic Knights. And after that, Poland and Lithuania merged into a Central European superpower, with territory stretching from the Baltic to the Black Sea. Its military focus is very much on duffing up the Swedes, the Russians and the Ottomans, rather than the Germans. In fact, towards the end, it forms a union with the Wettin dynasty from the German state of Saxony. But by the 18th century, Poland-Lithuania is falling to pieces in political, economic and military terms. And ultimately, it gets dismembered by Russia, Austria and Prussia in a series of three deals known as the Partitions, which ultimately snuff out Poland's existence as an independent state for 123 years.
Yeah, and that sets up a rather unfortunate precedent. I would say from that point onwards, it really, the relationship between the Polish people and the German people, such as they were at this point, really becomes a kind of series of disputes about Poland's struggle for independence, for it to come back together as a people, and obviously in the context of 19th century nationalism, even as a nation state. It continues to be really, I would say, the single most kind of emotional and evocative issue that defines that relationship. And when Germany was founded as a nation state in 1871, the so-called Polish question was already something that really determined, you know, the relationship between Germany and its Polish-speaking minority, which it now contained. If you take Prussia alone as a state, as part of this kind of new German empire, it contained around 2.5 million Poles, which was about 10% of the Prussian population. So it's quite significant. And one of the kind of biggest sources of conflict there was that the Prussian nobility, the so-called Junkers, continue to have disputes over land with Polish nobles, which really, you know, continue to sour the relationship between the two. The first German Chancellor, Otto von Bismarck, saw Poles, among many other groups, as Reichsfeinde, as he called it, so enemies of the state, and introduced a whole lot of kind of Germanization methods, as he saw it. So basically means by which the Polish people could be assimilated into his state. So he tried to suppress Catholicism. He tried to introduce and force German as a language onto even entirely Polish-speaking areas. And he also stood by when the Prussian authorities brutally expelled Poles from their land. But Polish resistance and the struggle for its independence remained strong and wasn't subdued by these measures.
Yeah. And in 1918, when Germany had been defeated at the end of the First World War, this struggle succeeded. Poland's independence was recognised by the victorious allies during this moment when so many nations gained their right to self-determination.
Yeah, one of the problems with this was that the victorious allies weren't entirely sure how to set up an independent Poland, at the same time guarantee that it would have access to the sea, and yet leave the very densely German populated areas, such as the area around Danzig, for example, or Königsberg, leave them with their right of self-determination at the same time, which directly conflicted with Poland's desire to do so. And so this rather awkward solution was found whereby the so-called Polish corridor was set up. So basically a strip of land that was given to Poland that now split German areas of East Prussia, or called East Prussia, off from the main bulk of the German state. And this gave nationalists, including Hitler, a lot of ammunition to work with politically.
Yeah, and in Hitler's policies during the Third Reich, the previous contours of the German-Polish relationship really found their most extreme and brutal incarnation. You had settlement turned into colonization and mass brutality under the banner of Lebensraum.
Yeah, and that obviously culminated in even more extreme violence during the Second World War. So you had Hitler's kind of genocidal waging of this war devastating Poland. It would cost an estimated 5 million Polish citizens their lives, among which were 3 million Jews. And his collusion with the Soviet Union under the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact partitioned Poland once more, and it evoked all of these old memories once again where sort of foreign powers east and west of Poland are dividing the country up between them, wiping out the nation in the process. But in this case, including the people themselves because of the genocidal nature of the war that Hitler was waging.
And that might help to explain the fairly radical solution that the Western Allies and the Soviet Union decided on after Germany had been defeated again in 1945. Basically, everything moved west, as something between 12 and 14 million ethnic Germans either fled or were driven out of Eastern Europe, as we've already talked about a bit in the episode on so-called Russian Germans. About 500,000 ethnic Germans left Poland immediately in the months after 1945, and then from February 1946, millions more were shipped out by the state. And at the same time, the USSR annexed more or less the eastern half of Poland's pre-war territory. These areas are now in Lithuania, Ukraine and Belarus. And in return, Poland got the German territories east of the rivers Oder and Neisser, where the border still is today. And that territory includes some pretty important cities, such as Wrocław, which is previously known in German as Breslau, and Szczecin, which used to be Stettin.
Yeah, it's interesting, this aspect, I find, because it dragged a lot of ordinary people into a conflict that had previously quite often been dominated by sort of the elites in society, if you will, so aristocrats fighting over land, political states fighting over land. But, you know, I've got family history there, for example. So 3 out of my 4 grandparents were among this group, came from East Prussia and from Pomerania and from the Sudetenland and settled in Germany. And whilst they were largely fairly unpolitical people, there was always kind of this idea that their home had basically vanished and was taken away from them. And it's something that was easily politicized in Germany by various political parties and groupings, both East and West, where, you know, people sort of longing for their homeland was made into political capital. This discussion around the land that was lost in the East was largely suppressed by the German Democratic Republic, East Germany, which obviously wanted to celebrate Russia as the sort of liberator and Poland and other Eastern European countries as brother states, and therefore couldn't really be doing with this kind of hostility between the two. And therefore, the GDR accepted those new borders fairly early on in the so-called Görlitzer Abkommen in 1950. But relations remained quite difficult nonetheless between East Germany and Poland, as basically suggestions continued to be wielded that this might just be a temporary solution and maybe negotiations over land and borders could be picked up again later. Ordinary people, meanwhile, started to come to terms with the situation, sort of particularly during the 1970s, once visa restrictions were lifted between East Germany and Poland, and many Germans travelled over there and spent their holidays on the Baltic Sea, for example, in Poland, and got to know Polish friends and people that they spend time with. And also many East Germans were quite fascinated by the political situation in Poland, particularly during the 1980s when the Solidarność trade union movement began to challenge the regime. So you had people like Angela Merkel, for example, fascinated by this, traveling to Poland to try and speak and discuss and talk to people who were involved in these political movements whilst the GDR was still kind of relatively settled and not much was going on in the early 1980s.
Yeah, if you look at the western side of Germany in that period, it was a very tricky relationship in the early years. Bonn was very reluctant to concede the loss of the so-called Ostgebiete, or Eastern Realms, those former German territories east of the Oder-Neisser line. And even the Social Democratic leader, Kurt Schumacher, said it would be treason to give them up. This may have been something to do with the fact that the Heimatvertriebene, the people who had been driven out of Eastern Europe and lost their homes, made up a very large and sort of very vocally organised section of the West German electorate. From the 1960s, really, the Pfennig began to drop, that those territories really were not coming back to Germany. And the West German government started talking about the possibility of reconciliation with Poland in 1965. It was in 1969 that the Polish leader, Władysław Gomułka, offered to talk to West Germany about normalising relations, and then the following year, the two sides settled the border question with the 1970 Treaty of Warsaw. And then there's a very famous moment a few days after that when Willy Brandt, the Social Democratic Chancellor, sinks to his knees beside a memorial to the Warsaw Ghetto. And we'll hear a bit more about how that went down in Poland a little later in the episode. It's also worth noting the religious connections between the two societies. About half the West German population was Catholic, and the clergy maintained ties to their Polish counterparts, especially in the struggle against communist rule. But at state level, you could almost argue that West Germany went a bit too far in reaching for an accommodation with the Polish regime in the end. In the early 1980s, once the Solidarność protest movement really started to get going, the government in Bonn basically sat back and did nothing because it was worried about the resulting instability and the danger of jeopardizing its detente with the Soviet Union.
Yeah, and you could really argue that unification should have been a moment where there was a real chance for Poland and Germany to really start the process of reconciliation without the context of the Cold War sort of overshadowing the whole thing. A lot of positive things did happen. So Poland joining the EU, for example, of course, helped merge Germany and Poland closer together, given that they were now both in the same political and ideological framework. This also meant that lots of Polish people were coming over to Germany to work and to settle down now that they could, basically without visa restrictions. So this meant that people were intermingling more. There were lots of language and cultural projects going on. There was the German-Polish year, for example, in 2005. And that really had an impact. So you could see in survey results across the years that most Germans, the vast majority of Germans, now think that the relations to Poland are good. And equally, the vast majority of Poles perceive Germany no longer as a threat. So these kind of baseline feelings that had been there, emotions that had been there for such a long time, were beginning to dissipate slowly but surely. However, there were different groupings and factions on both sides who kept demanding reparations. Germany for the lost land in the east, those Ostgebiete we were just talking about, and Poland for the damage that was done during the Second World War. Other issues consisted of things like the Nord Stream pipelines that Germany was building between Germany and Russia for energy. Poland was also saying, perhaps somewhat surprisingly in the context of the history between the two, that it didn't consider the Bundeswehr, the German army, to be fighting fit and therefore not capable of protecting Poland against Russia in a situation of conflict. There's also ongoing conflict between Brussels and Warsaw, which is often conflated in Poland with conflict with Germany directly. And Germany's ongoing very close relationship with Russia has also been a matter of concern for Poland.
Yeah, and all of this obviously came to a head with the Russian invasion of Ukraine on February the 24th last year. And it's resulted in a very interesting juncture in the German-Polish relationship. There's one way of looking at this, and last week I asked Anna Luhrmann, the German Europe Minister, about the relationship with Poland in an interview, and she basically said that Germany's security thinking had actually come a fair way round to the Polish point of view on things like the threat posed by Russia or the value of military deterrence. And as a result, she felt that actually the two countries had come a bit closer together. And that may well be true on a strategic level. But at the same time, on a political level, things actually seem to be getting worse. The intensity of the anti-German rhetoric from Warsaw has really gone up a notch ahead of the Polish elections this autumn. And I understand from a couple of German government sources that these sort of sniping from the sidelines is one of the very few things that visibly irritates Olaf Scholz. There's a tendency for German politicians to dismiss this as just sort of cynical populist posturing from Poland's ruling Law and Justice Party. And yet on the Polish side, there is very clearly a real and palpable sense that Germany just still isn't listening properly and isn't giving Poland anything like the level of respect it feels it deserves. The whole situation is summed up quite neatly in a new book by Rolf Nickel, who was the German ambassador to Warsaw from 2014 to 2020. And its title is Feinde, Fremde, Freunde, Enemies, Strangers, Friends.
It's interesting as well how many historical arguments are sort of dug out, particularly in the context of these, you know, political campaigns in Poland. It just seems as if history is never just history when it comes to German-Polish relations. But perhaps our expert guest can help us find a way out of these difficult things of the past and move towards a more neighbourly future.
I would like to welcome our distinguished guest for today, Karolina Wigura. Karolina is a historian of ideas, a sociologist and a journalist. She is a member of the board of the Kultura Liberalna Foundation, which publishes Poland's leading online political and cultural weekly magazine of the same name.
Karolina is also a lecturer at Warsaw University's Institute of Sociology, focusing on the political philosophy of the 20th century and emotions in politics, as well as the sociology and ethics of memory, including issues such as historical guilt and reconciliation.
So we are delighted to have her perspective on how Germany and Poland might move their complicated relationship forward. Karolina, welcome.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here.
Let's start with a very broad question. There is perhaps a tendency to think of international relations in quite kind of cold terms of national interests and things like that. But can you tell us a bit about how emotions come into the picture, particularly when we're talking about the Polish-German relationship?
Yes, we usually think about rationality in politics, but my main argument is that when we only focus on rationality, we basically forget about a very important perspective. I have been working for a couple of years on the 17th century philosophy of emotions, and it is very crucial to look at that for a moment, because this was probably the last moment, the 17th century, when European philosophy, or Western philosophy, if you like, focuses not on rationality, basically the word didn't exist at that time, but on reason. And those philosophers like Thomas Hobbes or Baruch Spinoza believed that reason can only function well if it's accompanied by the right emotions. So not all emotions are good for politics. Thomas Hobbes would say, for example, that superstitious fear is the worst thing that can actually happen if you want to have a stable state. But a fear, for example, that is connected with the past, with the atrocities of the past, is a good fear because it stabilizes the political situation, it stabilizes the society. So if you ask me about the Polish-German relations, you might say that for decades after the Second World War, these relations have been based on a very good emotion. It was an emotion which you could call the fear of the past. And this fear of the past helped Poles and Germans to launch a whole process of reconciliation after the Second World War. Actually, already in 1965, the Polish bishops wrote a famous letter at their German brothers, as they wrote, so at German bishops, Catholic bishops. And in the letter, which described 1,000 years of Polish-German history, they included this famous sentence, "We forgive and ask for forgiveness." As you can imagine, in Poland, 20 years after the war that was started by Germany, by Nazi Germany, to say "we forgive" and even more to say "we ask for forgiveness" was a scandal. It was a scandal. And the letter has been met by a furious reaction of the communist government. But actually, the society was also deeply, deeply wounded by the letter. But the letter, with time, started a whole series of mutual declarations of Poles and Germans. And so the Polish and German elites started to fight the fear, you can say, or alleviate the fear, work with the fear. Yet, I think if you ask me today about the Polish-German relations, we must say that the epoch I am talking about, the epoch of bishops and politicians arming each other, saying words of repentance and forgiveness to each other. So basically, people who had some moral authority saying things of forgiveness and repentance. This epoch is gone, is long gone. And what we say, what we see here is a deep crisis in Polish-German relations based on quite different emotions, which will be used as a chance, I believe, but it also brings a lot of dangers to the two neighboring countries of Central and Eastern Europe.
It's interesting that you mentioned this letter that the Polish bishops wrote, because I find it utterly remarkable that so briefly, you know, literally just a generation after the Second World War, Polish bishops would write to their German counterparts and basically ask for forgiveness. In turn, you also had a remarkable gesture by the West German Chancellor Willy Brandt just 5 years later in 1970, who basically fell on his knees in front of the Warsaw Ghetto Memorial as a gesture of atonement. Can you tell us just a little bit more about that and what effect that had?
That's a very good question because, it must be perhaps also said, it's quite important that the letter of the Polish bishops was a very open one and they also went very far. But the German bishops weren't so eager to answer in a very similar manner. They also asked for forgiveness in their letter, but they didn't say that they grant forgiveness. Perhaps a necessary footnote might be also given here. It is quite obvious what the Poles could be forgiving or not forgiving. But for what did they ask forgiveness? Well, for the way in which Germans were expelled from the territories that are now Western Poland, but belonged to Germany before the war. Of course, the decision was not of Poland. We weren't guests at Yalta, but still the Polish bishops were taking responsibility for the way in which it was done. But the fact that the German bishops didn't answer in the same way caused some bitterness on the Polish side. And Cardinal Wyszyński, who was one of the authors of the letter, years after wrote to other bishops on the German side that he was disappointed by the fact that the hand, as he wrote, the hand that was reached so eagerly from the Polish side wasn't taken by the German side eagerly enough, in his opinion. Now, as for the Willy Brandt's gesture, a very powerful gesture, Timothy Garton Ash, a British historian, once wrote that if the 20th century were to be described in one photo, in one photograph, this would be the photograph. Willy Brandt kneeling at the Warsaw Ghetto Memorial. But listen, this is not a gesture which was aimed at the Poles. It was a gesture which was aimed at the Jewish people who were victims of the Shoah and not at the Poles. And this was also seen by the Polish government and the Polish intellectuals. The Polish government basically didn't want to react at all. They didn't want to show it even in the media. The Polish intellectuals, on the other hand, understood that Germans have a lot to do in the Central and Eastern European region. So not only Polish victims are relevant. I think it's a quite different story, this gesture. Not a story of Polish-German reconciliation, but an important story of how Germany, after the Second World War, was changing its attitude and politics towards its own history.
It seems like so much of the modern history of the German-Polish relationship is a story of missed opportunities for reconciliation. And to those examples you've already cited, one could add the early 1990s after the fall of communism, or the moment when Poland joined the EU in 2004, or last February when Russia attacked Ukraine and confirmed a lot of Poland's warnings about the geopolitical risks in Eastern Europe. So I'd like to ask, to what extent that reconciliation ever did really take place, and what do you think the biggest missed opportunities were?
Listen, there is nothing like a finished and accomplished reconciliation between nations. It's quite different than when two individuals reconcile with each other, because then we basically speak about the decision of will. I want to forgive, hence I forgive. It's like a promise. And usually we tend to think, of course, the situation might be much more complicated, but basically we think that when forgiveness is granted, then the process has ended. It is quite different in the case of two societies and two nations because they evolve the whole time. So in the case of Polish-German reconciliation, I would rather speak about phases, not about one and forever ended and accomplished process of reconciliation. I would say that in the definition of the former epoch, the epoch when globally many politicians were traveling and asking for forgiveness for not only for the Shoah, not only for politics in Europe, but also for colonialism, etc., etc. So this in the categories of the former epoch, of those festive ceremonies with photographs and lamps and shooting lamps, the reconciliation was somehow accomplished, but it has been not accomplished in the new sense. I will explain now what I mean. First, the moral authorities don't play such a big role anymore, neither in Poland nor in Germany nor in the globalized world. We live in the times of social media, when individuals have a stronger voice than ever before. A French sociologist, Pierre-Rosan Vallon, calls it the individualism of singularity. We define our attitude to politics, our emotions, not with regard to the society we come from, the social group we come from, but rather regarding our own experience. So this is the singularity. And from this perspective, the fact that someone says we should now forgive the Germans, or we should now repent because of what we have done to some other nation, this is not, that doesn't have to be convincing. And we see more and more that those gestures of yesterday, they do not have such an influence as they did before. This is one thing. Another thing is the influence of the war in Ukraine. Namely, as you very rightly said, the war in Ukraine confirmed something. It has confirmed that there is a very relevant and important experience of Russian imperialism that has been coming back not for 10 years, not for 20 years, but for 300 years in Central and Eastern European region. From this point of view, not only Warsaw, but also Tallinn, Vilnius, and other places in Central and Eastern Europe say today, we have been right, and Germany wasn't. And from this, there is this large wave of criticism towards Germany and its international politics in the past years. I do believe that from this point of view, also the reconciliation is to be started anew, because suddenly there are new contexts. And the last thing I want to say about the change that we are going through is the contrast between the Polish-German reconciliation and the Polish-Ukrainian reconciliation. After 1989, Poles and Ukrainians attempted to have a very similar reconciliation process that was before accomplished between Poland and Germany. So again, visits to important places, festive ceremonies, mutual declarations, etc., etc. And you know what? Nobody listened. It was not relevant to anybody. There were a lot of resentments because of very complicated Polish-Ukrainian history that took place mostly during the Second World War, after the Nazis basically radicalized the nationalist groups in Ukraine, but also before, because of Poland's role in Ukraine as a state that we very often say today was colonizing Ukrainian territory. So there was a very bitter relation, despite the attempts to reconcile. But then political practice changed everything. So we had first the Orange Revolution, then the Euromaidan, and now we have the war in Ukraine, and the vast popular support for Ukraine and for democratic Ukraine in Poland changed a lot and gained a lot of trust in Ukrainians. And this is what basically I would call a root reconciliation, not an elite reconciliation, but a root reconciliation that we have had with the Ukrainians since 2004, at least, protesting here against attempts to install Russian influence in Kiev, supporting the democratic change and the westernization of Ukraine, going to Ukraine when that or other revolution started. This has changed a lot, the relations, and it has prepared the ground for the millions of Ukrainians who came to Poland and were greeted with understanding and with welcoming hands. I think it's an extremely important example. And now we can, of course, ask if this root reconciliation of citizens, not of politicians, not of intellectuals, was so successful in the Polish-Ukrainian case, how can we attempt to have this as an inspiration for the Polish-German relations?
So if we're saying that the reconciliation process between Germany and Poland is now taking place in a different international context, and especially one that places less emphasis on sort of grand gestures from prominent politicians and public figures, I wonder whether perhaps money plays a larger role in this process. Poland has issued a demand for Germany to pay 1.3 trillion euros in reparations for the crimes of the Second World War, which Germany summarily rejected. What does this mean to Poles? And does it feed into perhaps a wider sense that Germany does not take their interests or perspectives as seriously as it might?
There was an essay in The Economist that the title said, "Why do Poles love to hate the Germans?" And this essay was basically about the money, about the fact that Poland would expect from Germans paying those 1.3 billion euros. And I think it's actually not only about the money. Perhaps even I would risk and say that not the money is the most important thing. I do believe that there are more important things at stake here. The first would be the dignity and changing from a junior partner to a senior partner. I will now explain what I mean. When Poland was aspiring to go into the European Union and NATO, especially in the case of European Union, Germany played a role of its ambassador, of its gate to the European Union. From this time, since then, in Germany and also in other Western European countries, there was an ongoing debate whether the Eastern enlargement was a good idea. Well, whether it was or it wasn't a good idea, from that time, Poland and other Central and Eastern European countries have changed immensely. They have westernized immensely. And even if Poland has problems with its constitutional order today, due to the current government, the feeling, the collective feeling in Warsaw and also in other Central and Eastern European states is that it is not the time anymore to be a junior partner. So I think it is about the money, but equally it's about distribution of dignity and about meeting some frustrations of the political partners that are situated eastern from Germany.
That's such an interesting point about the distribution of dignity. And on that note, I've been struck very often by the sheer intensity of the German bashing, frankly, that comes from the ruling Law and Justice Party in Poland, even to the point where parts of Poland that tend to vote for opposition parties, such as the old Hanseatic cities like Gdansk or parts of Silesia, get labelled German. And when you talk to German officials about this, they very often put it entirely down to sort of domestic politicking on the part of the Law and Justice Party. What I'd be curious to hear from you is, first of all, why anti-German rhetoric is such an effective political tool in Poland. Secondly, is this just a domestic political game in Poland, or is there something more serious behind it? And thirdly, is it just the Law and Justice Party, or do you think it would be similar under any Polish government?
Well, listen, the biggest surprise in the past few months was that when the Law and Justice Party came up with the idea of asking for reparations again, the opposition leader, Donald Tusk, didn't say it's a bad idea. He said, yes, it's a good idea. And apart from that, we could also demand reparations from Russia. So as you can see, something has vastly changed, shifted in the collective atmosphere, in the collective emotion. Now, to answer your question, why is it so effective? I think for many reasons. I will just name two. The first reason is, of course, that we see in the sociological data that there is a group of Poles who are voters of Law and Justice Party, who basically are afraid of the West, and Berlin is the personification of this West. So among this group, the support for reparations as a feasible idea is the biggest. It's 70%. Apart from that, we have also other groups of voters who do not support Law and Justice. But given what Donald Tusk said, that he actually didn't say it's a ridiculous idea, he said yes, and let's expand it, we can derive from that that there is something more, and this is what I have called the need for different distribution of dignity. I think it's the reaction of the Polish society to a vast lack of knowledge about Poland and Poles in the German society. Let's be honest. Those are very close neighbors, Poland and Germany. We could be very good partners, and economically, we are very good partners, by the way. But as for the knowledge, those two societies have scarce knowledge about each other, but the knowledge is smaller on the German side. And at the same time, the moral responsibility on the German side is bigger. And I do believe that this causes a serious frustration in vast groups of Polish society. And this is how it is being articulated, by this effectiveness of the asking for reparations. So again, the right answer would be not only a financial answer. It would be probably rather an answer that would provide a serious thinking and actions on how we can broaden the knowledge of Poland, of contemporary Poland, but also of history of Poland in Germany. By the way, this is not only about Poland. We can see it very well in the current discussion about German politics and delivering arms to Ukraine, about German position in this war in Ukraine that has been caused by Vladimir Putin. Namely, the Germans have been learning for many, many years that Nazi Germany caused massive destruction and loss of life. And as for numbers, the biggest victim was the Soviet Union. But then only few people, only not very vast groups of people are aware what it actually meant. And this is very well described in Bloodlands by Timothy Snyder. Namely, that the Soviet Union as such could be the biggest victim as for the number of the deaths. But in fact, the Ukrainians and the Belarusians and the Poles were biggest victims. Those were the bloodlands. In this respect, I think what it calls for is not only change in relation to Poland, but actually change in relation to Eastern and Central Europe. And I think also, because Germany has been so inspiring and so wonderful in reflecting on its own guilt and responsibility, perhaps it's also time to think about guilt in a very old and new sense, in a way. Karl Jaspers has written this wonderful and important essay, which is called The Schuldfrage, The Question of Guilt. And he dealt there with the German guilt, of course. But I think it's the time, and we could do it in Europe, we could do it together, and then we could talk about it with the Russian intellectuals. I think it's the time to ask the question of the Russian guilt.
Well, there's clearly a lot more to be done in terms of discussing this question and also improving knowledge and understanding on all sides. But I'm afraid we are out of time for this podcast at this point. Thank you so much, Carolina, for all your insights and the knowledge that you've brought to this. I think it is a really, really important discussion that needs to be continued certainly at all levels. And if we've made a kind of modest contribution to that, I'm very pleased about that. And if you, dear listeners, would like to also maybe hear more from Carolina Vigura about her research and her findings and her analysis, you can find many of her articles online or in various newspapers, or buy a copy of her book, which is called The End of the Liberal Mind, Poland's New Politics, which discusses Poland's illiberal shift after 2015.
Many thanks for your attention, as one says in German, for bearing with us today as we discuss the complicated and difficult subject of German-Polish relations. What happens between these two powerful states in Central Europe will be crucial for politics on the continent and globally.
Thank you so much. I was delighted to be here.
Now, with all of the serious politics out of the way, surely there's time for at least one joke in this episode.
With all due respect for your effervescent wit, I'm not sure this is quite the time for a German to tell a joke about German-Polish relations.
Well, of course, I wasn't dreaming of doing that. I mean, you know, jokes about Germans and Poles are really the worst.
We'll catch you. You really did just settle there for a cheesy sausage pun. It's truly the worst case of scenario.
Nice one. Nicely finished.
Well, listeners, if you want more of Katja's high-quality output, you can follow her on Twitter, where her handle is @Hoya_Kat. And as her homework for this week, she's now going to have to come up with an equally uproarious pun about kielbasa.
I'm not sure I can match this one, but if you want to let Oliver know just how much you enjoy my jovial contributions, you can also find them on Twitter, @OliverNMoody.
I'm sure my mentions will be flooded. Thank you for listening to this episode of The New Germany, a special series of the Körber Stiftung's History and Politics podcast.
Adieu from Sussex.
And bis denne from Berlin.